from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary from Alexandria Eidenberg, Amara Enya, Mike Miller, and Stephen Turner. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8029. 1-800-723-8029. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video, beyondthebeltway.com. If you ever miss it live on Sunday night, you can go there for weeks or months or perhaps years and watch the broadcast. We've got a lot of them there. And tonight, we begin our 38th year of our weekly gathering to talk about politics in America. And, again, as I mentioned last week in the 37th anniversary show, we thank you very much for joining us. If you're new to the show, it's great to have you with us. And if you've been with us for a long time, I think you'll say that we're pretty much consistent on what we talk about, or at least positions that we offer on this program. Tonight, we're going to spend the vast majority of the program talking about health care. And we have a couple of experts here on opposite sides of the political spectrum that are going to share their thoughts. And I want to begin with asking them a question. Steve, I want to ask you a question. This is Steve Turner. Steve, the question that I would ask to you is, if nothing happens, if the Republicans can't get their act together, can't get the votes, and things stay just as they are, look into your crystal ball. What will happen?
We will have the rest of the individual market disintegrate, probably in a very short period of time. We have lost 17 carriers in the last 3 years. We have three carriers that cater to the individual market: Blue Cross, Cigna, which only offers HMOs, and then a little company called Ambetter that's with Celtic. So we've really lost a lot of options. So if we do not continue to incentivize insurance companies, and what I mean by the incentivize is hand them hundreds of billions of dollars of taxpayer money, they will not continue offering individual products because they've lost all of this money. We just lost our fourth one, Harkin Health. We lost them 2 weeks ago. They lost $63 billion in 12 months.
So I would like to ask Alexandria Eidenberg, who also joins us for the very first time, the answer to the same question. What is it? Let's say we do nothing. What happens, in your view?
The Affordable Care Act has definitely been really hard on the carriers. I agree with Stephen. The carriers are bleeding money for the Affordable Care Act. I don't think that the Affordable Care Act is working, but it's working way better than Trump Care. And ultimately, the problem with the Affordable Care Act is that it's expensive. The prices are driving. And so without any change, we're going to see higher rates, smaller networks, and less options. And that's not good for the people. Ultimately, the Affordable Care Act was supposed to serve the people and give them more options, give them more access. At the end of the day, I think we all just want Obamacare for cheaper, and that's a really hard equation.
Mike Miller also joins us. He is a card-carrying economist, a Republican, an admitted Republican. But not you were not a big Trump supporter.
No, I was a case
but
guy.
You can certainly offer your political assessment. What happens if the Republicans could get nothing done?
It is going to collapse, and being a family that actually purchases it, and it went up last year in Illinois 107%, with a rise in the amount for the deductible. We Republicans told the Democrats this was going to fail, and we were told we were fools. I sat at this exact chair across from Democrats, and they told me I was a fool for thinking this. And we just knew it was going to happen. As an economist with all the problems, it wasn't truly insurance. This is what was going to happen.
Amara Enya is our card-carrying Democrat tonight. Amara, what happens if nothing happens politically, from a political standpoint?
I think it continues to decline. I mean, I have sort of a different perspective in that I was a big proponent for single payer prior to the Affordable Care Act. That's something that I thought we could have pushed and should have pushed. I understand why the president didn't do that. But I think it continues to decline. It has been difficult as someone who has experience, personal experience with the Affordable Care Act, with Obamacare, if you will, and it had not been it wasn't a positive experience. And so
Do the Republicans or the Democrats, who pays a bigger political price? We've talked about the policy. Who plays a bigger political price, Mike?
Well, if nothing is done, a lot of people will just simply have to step away. They won't be able to afford it. And that will be a disaster for the Democrats. If the Republicans step in, there's no doubt that fewer will be covered, even if it is people voluntarily stepping away. Mm-hmm. and that is going to hurt the Republicans.
Who pays the big
political
price? I think
the Republicans, because they had so much time, this was their clarion call for the last several years. They had an opportunity to craft a plan, something that would make more sense, something that they could get buy-in, even on the Republican side, and push. And quite frankly, they should have been ready from day one of the Trump administration to push a plan that could work, and they didn't. And so I think they do actually take a political hit for that, or should.
I want to talk about from a standpoint of what we know now about the Republican plan, and obviously it doesn't have enough votes right at the moment.
Right.
But are the Republicans, in your view, Steve, going in the right direction?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Are you enthusiastic about all aspects of it? Or
no, not at all. But they are in the right direction, and what I mean by that is, we hear a lot of narrative from our friends on the left saying that it's going to kill people and women will be denied pregnancy and maternity coverage and all this hyperbolic tripe, and none of it's true. It is really a bipartisan bill. We're doing things and expanding upon successes from the Affordable Care Act. One of them is bundled payments. There were 32 pioneer ACOs, accountable care organizations, that were set up under Obamacare. The original idea was under George W. Bush. They expanded it massively under the Affordable Care Act. And with the evidence we're getting back after only 3 years is very, very encouraging. This is an idea where you give a hospital system or a group of doctors or a surgical center one lump sum payment, and they must operate amongst that one lump sum payment. If they beat the payment, meaning they perform quality metrics that are better than what was assumed by CMS, they get a bonus payment. And in the Senate bill, we provide an $8 billion bonus fund for states that actually meet the quality metrics and can actually manage their money under one lump payment. We're doing that
so
under Medicare.
Alexander, less care, they get less. I mean, it's just that's encouraging doctors and hospitals to not have the standard of care that they should.
Not at all.
Because of course they're going to.
Alexander, let me ask you: is there any aspect of the Republican plan that you know about that's out there that's being debated? Is there any aspect of that you think is good?
Genuinely, I'm not a fan of any of it. I think the biggest concern is that it's hitting the lowest part of the totem pole when we're going to hurt the lowest earners and mostly Medicaid and just rip that coverage from them.
Oh, come on.
That's terrifying.
Come on.
And as a woman who just had a baby 7 weeks ago, I need maternity coverage. And
no one's taking maternity away from you. No one's taking maternity away from you.
So that women cannot get subsidized and buy off the individual market. That's part of the bill.
No,
part of the bill states that. Yes, it does.
No, it
says
isn't.
That you cannot get maternity coverage
nonsense.
While subsidized.
Nonsense. One,
women
for the
well,
first,
well,
but here's one of the problems.
Go ahead.
For the first time in U.S. history, Republicans, not Democrats, are providing advanced premium tax credits for people under the federal poverty level to get private health insurance. Under Obamacare now, if you make less than 138% of federal poverty level in this state, which is $16,248, you're relegated to Medicaid. You can't get private health insurance unless you can afford to pay for the whole premium. Republicans say, why should we discriminate against people who are poor and those who are not poor? Everyone should have access to Blue Cross. Everyone should have access to the same doctors and hospitals. And that's what we're doing with the Senate bill.
We got to pause. 1-800-723-8 If you have a question for the Republican plan, if you are a firm believer that Obamacare is the greatest thing since sliced bread and want to keep it, let us know. 1-800-723-8029. Taking America's political pulse on health care tonight, coast to coast and border to border and around the world on BeyondTheBeltway.com.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and we're talking about healthcare this evening. Steve, one of the, by the way, I should mention, your name is Stephen Tucker.
Thank you. I misspoke
earlier, and we will correct it, but I apologize for
Thank
that. When the one part of this discussion that seems to get a lot of publicity, a lot of headlines, it's brought up in every interview, and that is the CBO, which says that 22 million people mm-hmm. will not be able to participate in Trump Care. Do you believe that's true?
I do not. The problem with the CBO, it's not even really the CBO's fault. They cannot score future legislation that hasn't passed the Senate yet. So what they're telling you is if you take away the individual mandate, about 15 million people are just going to choose not to mm-hmm. purchase health insurance. So that's a huge portion of the 22 million people. So do I believe they're correct in those assessments? I can't until I see them score the final bill. They haven't seen the alternative bill yet, right? It's us to go to conference
would
committee.
Would you acknowledge that from a political standpoint, Mike, would you acknowledge that having that headline out there makes it very difficult
sure.
for Republican members of Congress
yeah.
when they go back home and they're meeting the folks for the 4th of July holidays?
Sure.
That headline itself is an albatross around their neck.
It is absolutely the case. There's one other aspect to it. Not only have they not taken a look at the final bill, a lot of this is done by economists, and I can assure you we are notoriously bad at forecasting that far into the future with coming up numbers. The numbers under Obamacare are completely wrong. The numbers of every major social program going back, the numbers with regard to budget deficits and surpluses. Believe it or not, in 2000 when we had a surplus, people were predicting there would be no national debt by 2009. We were going to pay the whole thing off. It's absolutely true. What was the Fed going to do without treasuries in their portfolio? These forecasts are preposterous. We have to have something, but these forecasts right. cannot be trusted.
And they've been historically horribly wrong.
That data, though, is showing that it's
Alexander.
Not most people on the individual market that are not going to be taking the benefits. It's the Medicaid people. It's Medicaid people losing their benefits. We are talking about our lowest wage earners, the people that need us most.
It's individual and
are
Medicaid.
The people that are not – the statistics are showing 84% of people that will lose the coverage of that 22 million, Medicaid people. These are our lowest wage earners who need us most of all. Are you telling me you don't care about these people?
Oh, God, the hyperbole. Okay. As I just mentioned in the previous segment, Republicans, for the first time in U.S. history, are providing an off-ramp from Medicaid. You understand that Medicaid outcomes are worse than any other kind of health insurance in the country.
That's not true.
It's absolutely true. The Oregon study proves it's true. In fact, there are two economists, one from MIT and one from Harvard, that says the benefit that Medicaid recipients get from every dollar the federal government spends is 2 to 6 cents. It's a horrible program.
You're talking about what the hospitals want from it, though. Yes, the hospitals are earning less from the Medicaid reimbursements, but that has nothing to do with the
hospitals are earning
outcomes.
More since we expanded
hospitals,
Obamacare. They're making a killing off of Medicaid
On Medicaid
expansion.
And Medicare, they base their entire platform on reimbursements, inpatient care, and everything.
Listen, when people lose Medicaid in 2023, when it happens, when we repeal Medicaid expansion, we're providing them private health insurance. I have clients.
That
I'm
they
sure
can't
you
afford.
Do. Yes, they can afford it because we're providing $63 billion in a long-term stability fund. Another $50 billion in a short-term stability fund, and McConnell's talking about doubling the long-term stability fund to $126 million. A billion dollars. In addition to that, we're keeping the cost-sharing subsidies going. Remember, Republicans filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration for appropriating that money without congressional approval. We're letting it continue so that the people not only get an advanced premium tax credit, but a cost-sharing reduction subsidy to lower those premiums and deductibles. We're doing that even though we're evil Republicans. This is a bipartisan
bill. I
don't think
it's about being evil by any means.
But that's what we've been called.
Alexandria, go ahead.
I think that it's about wealthy people making decisions for low-income wage earners and the middle class, and that's unacceptable that they're not considering their needs.
So
people
you want to cut
Medicaid,
congressional salaries so some poor people
would,
are grabbing the bill?
I would love if congressional salaries were
I
cut.
I would,
that
too.
They weren't on,
I actually
you know,
would
permanent
on that.
Pensions.
But that's fantasy land compared to reality.
I agree, but you mentioned it, so I answered. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it is our job as Americans to make sure that those in need have access.
And Amen.
That's what Medicaid has done year
Amen.
After year for the people.
No, it has not. Not since Obamacare Medicaid expansion. We reimburse
people
to people
love
who
love Obamacare.
Who people,
they just want it to be cheaper.
Who people who
They're
are on,
totally happy.
People who were on Medicaid before Medicaid expansion get reimbursed at 51% compared to 90%. Under Obamacare Medicaid expansion. So the people who are neediest are getting the shaft under Obamacare Medicaid expansion.
Folks, we're going to take a call. Bonnie in Northwest Indiana, go ahead. You're on the air listening on the internet tonight. Go ahead.
You know, and I hate to say this, but when I heard the beginning of the show, and I'm watching it, you know, on the video screen.
Yeah.
The lady with the curly hair and the glasses.
Alexandria.
Yes, when she came right out and said that the Republican plan was worse. You know what? At that point, I literally started ignoring everything that she said, only because, first of all, we don't have a final Trump care yet. And the fact that a person would make a comment like that, and she is unable to counter the facts and the numbers and the studies that are presented to her, and she cannot accept, you know, accept them and acknowledge them. You know, I wonder why you bring on such hugely partisan people.
First of all, let me just say we're starting our 38th year. We bring on partisan people on this program. We bring on nonpartisan people from time to time, but we live in a partisan world. So I'm going to let Alexandra sort of defend herself. But we like vibrant debate here.
I totally appreciate your opinion. Thank you. I believe, and in my opinion, the current Trump care bill, as they call it, the current Senate bill, is not something that's going to serve the American people, and I don't like it. I definitely appreciate that you're for it, and I think that that's what it's all about. We need to figure out a way to come together and serve the vast majority of the American people, and that's what this is all about. And I don't believe that the Republicans are putting out a bill that's going to get that done.
But by the way, you were with the organization, you were the founder of an organization called Mom Plus Baby.
That's correct.
What is that?
Mom Plus Baby is a nonprofit organization that helps women get involved in the legislative process. So we empower women to get involved both locally and federally in legislation, if that's registering to vote for the first time and voting, or if that's helping write a bill or lobbying on a bill. We help them get involved in that process and feel empowered to do so.
Okay. And let's take a moment. Tell the audience, what are your credentials in this discussion?
I'm a principal broker for healthinsurancementors.com, a 21-year licensed brokerage firm, multi-state license. I do mostly individual health insurance products. The individual market has been destroyed by Obamacare in about 36 months. So it's more and more increasingly difficult to find quality care for people, right?
You
agree with me on that?
Yeah.
It's been an absolute disaster. Unlike, as Mike mentioned, properly, we were promised that it would improve health care, improve choices.
This isn't what
if you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. And all this hyperbolic nonsense from Barack Obama, none of it was true.
Amara, you mentioned something in the first segment. I want to give a chance to elaborate, because every once in a while someone will bring up single payer. What does that mean for the audience?
Well, for me, it's just I guess the frustration that I have is that I thought that we had an opportunity, and Senator Sanders, who I was a very staunch supporter,
yes,
really pushed the single payer option before he was running for president, and it's something that I thought we had an opportunity to do. Once Obamacare was rolled out and some of the challenges that it had, what became evident is that we probably missed our opportunity to really push for single payer, and instead ended up working with a very flawed plan that now we have to make the most of it. And now it's the Republicans who won in the election, and now they have an opportunity to take a crack at it. My concern is that on the Republican side, again, there's room to craft a plan that actually could work, but the way that I would test its effectiveness is to see what are some of the associations saying? How are they involved in the process? And I mean medical associations, professional organizations that are deeply involved in healthcare. What are they saying about the Republican plan? How are we working with other partners who might not be naturally allies in this debate to make sure that their voices are included in the process as well? That's how you would gauge the effectiveness, so that it doesn't become just, we did Obamacare, now we're doing Trump care.
Now, Rand Paul, who is a leading opponent of this plan as well, there's about seven or eight other Republicans, but he was on television today, and he, along with Ben Sasse, the senator from Nebraska, they have come up with an idea that really you should repeal it first and then replace it, but separate the bill. Don't try to do the same thing in the same bill. Is that a good idea, Mike?
I saw Rand Paul's interview. I thought it was outstanding, but it does place the question into two different camps. If what you want is insurance in the traditional sense of the word, that you pay a premium based upon the probability of payout, so the sicker you are, the more you pay, the healthier you are, the less you pay, the younger you are, the less you pay, the older you are, the more you pay. All these things, if you want to be able to buy across state lines, if you want to maybe go and try to get into a group, if you want true insurance, then he's the man. But if you want a government program that's going to be put together like a Rube Goldberg mess, which is what we have, and which we were told was not the case just a little while ago, we will have what we have now.
But he thinks the Republican plan, the McConnell plan, so the other guy from Kentucky, he thinks that this that they're just loading this Republican plan up with Christmas trees. They're buying votes,
yes,
just like the Democrats
subsidies,
have done.
Huge quantities of
and
subsidies.
And he is opposed to it. So I guess my question would be this. If what the Republicans need first and foremost is to go back to their constituents and say, you know what, we repealed this. We repealed it. Okay, mm-hmm. Republicans, they would feel good about that. Then the next question is, okay, how are we going to replace it? Now, when you replace it, you're not going to have the conservatives and the moderates in the Republican Party together. Doesn't that force a bipartisan position where Democrats may jump on board? You're shaking your head no.
First of all, you cannot repeal Obamacare without 60 votes in the U.S. Senate. We only have 53 with Mike Pence. It's not going to happen. So it's political posturing by conservatives saying, I want to be on record saying I voted for repeal, but I didn't vote for any kind of replacement, right? I understand where that's coming from. In the real world, we do have to work together in the Senate to come up with some sort of reform so that people are left with some sort of options in the individual health insurance market.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8229 from coast to coast and border to border. Callers on the line. We will bring them into the conversation when we roll on. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, Jason, I've got to tell you, you're pretty much everything this company is looking for in an entry-level candidate.
Great.
Your resume isn't quite what we're used to, but you've got a fantastic work ethic.
Thank you.
And I'm impressed by how you carry yourself.
So, should we talk about the job?
What? The job? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I have no way of recruiting or even meeting you. This interview didn't happen.
It may sound ridiculous, and that's because it kind of is. There's a huge pool of talent your company is missing out on. Meet the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
Man, we really could have used him.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Alexandra Eidenberg joins us. She supports Obamacare and hates Trump Care, even what she's been reading in the papers about it. My question to you, though, is insofar as I want to look at the sort of the ages involved, insofar as Obamacare right now, are there would you describe are there some winners and losers in Obamacare based on the age of the recipient?
So it depends on if you're talking about individual or group market. With the group market, we've seen our clients, I own an insurance agency called The Insurance People. We specialize in employee benefits and individual health insurance, but do mostly those group benefits. What we've seen is that the older you are, the more you're loving it. Lower deductibles, vast array of plans to pick from, large networks, lots of access. If you're talking about that individual market, it's pretty much horrible. Once you get to 50, the rates are just so high, it becomes almost unaffordable. However, the less money you make, the more you get subsidized. And the older you are, the larger your subsidy because it's a swinging scale. So if your rate's higher, your subsidy is deeper. Unfortunately, not everyone is subsidized. And so I will tell you, as someone who's paying full rate, I'm a little bit jealous when I see someone getting subsidized with a $0 deductible paying $50 a month. And that's not everybody, but a lot of people are benefiting from those subsidies.
Steve, looking at the Republican plan as known right now.
Yeah.
Are there winners and losers based on their age?
Yeah, currently, until we add more funding, I would say there would be a problem or a disparity when you're in your 60s, right, before you get to Medicare, what I call the healthcare promised land. Right, would you agree?
$0 deductible. Everything's covered.
That's right. Exactly. Buy a Medicare supplement, that's it.
Until it's broke.
Until it's broke. Thank you,
and
Mike,
speaking
for
as an economist,
bringing some reality in there. Anyway, so there's winners and losers. if we don't provide more money for those above 350% of the federal poverty level and they're in the age of 60, 64 years old before they go to Medicare, there could be a problem there. So they're addressing that currently, looking at doubling the state's ability fund, the long-term state's ability fund. So I think by the time we get it through the conference committee, the House version, the Senate version, they scream and yell at each other, something out the other end, I think will ensure that both people in that age group are going to be much better off.
All right, let's go to Tom listening to us in Youngstown on WKBN. Go ahead.
Good evening, Bruce, and to your guest, and happy birthday, America.
Thank you.
You know, Bruce, you're a good friend and somebody who I enjoy listening to as much as I enjoy listening to your program. Jim Bohannon says that Obamacare is unconstitutional, and he bases it on the fact that, it, if you recall, in my memory, it seems to be the case, that it was initiated in the Senate. Mary Landrieu was incentivized with a couple $100 million going to her area in Louisiana Purchase, and there was a Nebraska kickback and a couple of other situations involved. And then it later went to the Supreme Court on the basis of whether or not it was constitutional to force Americans to buy a product or a service. And John Roberts, in the majority opinion, gave all the reasons why it shouldn't be, but then in the end said, after all, it's a tax, so it's okay. Well, Article 1, Section 7, very first sentence of the Constitution, on that section, all bills for raising revenue originate in the House of Representatives.
Yep.
And revenue is a tax. Now, if that's the case, then we can't fix Obamacare. My suggestion is that we form a commission very similar to what was done with the base closings and a bipartisan commission, and hopefully keep as few politicians involved as possible, but people who, you know, are from the medical professions, insurance and business and other people of that nature, take a year, put together a combination of what is the best from both the Republicans and the Democrats' suggestions, and that way it would be bipartisan. Both sides are winners, and both sides can, you know, if something needs to be repaired later on, it would be readily be repaired because there's no Republicans or Democrats to blame.
Amara, how realistic is Tom's idea?
It's very well reasoned. I think it's very well reasoned in terms of...
So it will go nowhere in Washington.
In this current climate, unfortunately, that's the reality. I do think that, you know, this process that he just outlined is what would make the most sense to come out with something that is workable, and that I think both sides could actually come to some kind of agreement. But I think the toxic environment means that this will be just as partisan as Obamacare was. Mm-hmm. And that's what it's shaking out to be. And I think we miss an opportunity to really come up with a plan that makes the most sense for the people because of the partisan politics that's driven a lot of the process.
But of course, the Roberts' decision is what makes his whole analysis absolutely correct and wrong at the same time. President Obama is on record verbally saying this is not a tax. Mm-hmm. This is Obamacare. Mm-hmm. So it's the fact, can you force an American to buy a product that they don't want? Is that constitutional? I think the answer would have been, no, it is not. And Roberts realized that. So what he did, he says, oh, well, it is constitutional because this is under the taxing power of the government. But that immediately then makes it unconstitutional because it must emanate from the House of Representatives, correct, Ways and Means, not from the Senate. Mm-hmm. So he, and I think it's just a case where the Republicans figured and anybody else, what's the point? What's the point of, they're going to find some other way around it, and they're not going to rule that this is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely correct. If it is in fact a tax, which is what Robert says it is unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. So, and if it was not a tax, which Mr. Obama said it was, in my mind, the government cannot force an individual to buy a product they don't want. That, to me, is unconstitutional. And so it was unconstitutional. No matter how we do it, we still have it.
Tom, thanks for your call. Good idea. We don't know how realistic it is, but again, we look for good ideas from beyond the Beltway. This was probably as good a one as we've heard this evening, at least. Steve, I want to go back to you on where you think this goes next. I mean, you know... the sides are drawn in the Senate, the Republicans. We're just talking about the Republicans now because mm-hmm. this looks like it's going to be a Republican-only plan.
Yep.
Who's going to how are they going to put these pieces together amongst those divergent views in the Republican Party?
More and more money. Mitch McConnell has about $100 billion that he can still spend. So it's going to be paying off different special interest groups, making sure they're happy. Susan Collins will be happy. This person will be happy. Eventually, they'll get enough of the moderates together with the conservatives, and they're going to come up with something. The biggest reason we know
so
it's...
So you think he will still get some conservatives, or is he putting all of his eggs in the moderate basket?
Oh, absolutely.
What's he going to give to conservatives if he's loading up a Christmas tree?
Well,
it doesn't appear like he's going to get Rand Paul.
Probably not, but he'll get Senator Cruz. He might get Rand Paul in the end. I really believe he will, but nevertheless... We know it's going to happen. The biggest reason we know it's going to happen is because we need the spending cuts in the health care proposal to fund President Trump's tax reform. And there are a lot more people in this country that want tax reform than want health insurance reform. So it's going to happen.
The tax reform is really for the wealthy, though. It's just lining the pockets of the wealthy again. I don't understand why we have to serve the wealthy.
Seven brackets to three. It helps everybody.
But who does it help the most? The uber wealthy.
Of course, because that's who pays the taxes the most, of course.
People making less than $50,000 pay about 4% of the income tax.
Thank you, Mike.
I appreciate
Thank
that
you.
The less you make, the less you pay.
But at the end of the day,
if you're making a ton of money, you should be paying in more.
We have a progressive income tax. That's how it works.
When does that fairness stop? At what percent? How much of the rich money
I don't
can
think
you
it
take?
Does, actually. And I think that that's what.
Should they take 80%?
I think that that's a little out of control, definitely.
70%?
You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't think we can expect a low-wage earner to pay the same tax as a wealthy person.
They don't. Wealthy people pay taxes on dividends. They don't pay taxes on income. It's not the same rate.
Steve, go ahead. Make your point.
It's not the same rate. Somebody who's a secretary, they pay taxes based on their income. People who are wealthy invest their money. They pay a different tax rate on dividends earned on the investments. It's not comparing apples to apples. Not even close.
A lot of
people to invest.
Yes, we do, which is why we repeal the
3.8%. Let me just go back to you on this issue of the wealthy not paying enough. Didn't we just have an election about that, and didn't the other side, the Trump side, win?
Mm-hmm.
This was heavily debated. It was an integral part of Bernie Sanders' campaign. He didn't win the Democratic nomination for a variety of reasons.
Which I didn't agree with. I really thought he should have been our guy, and I think that you're in that boat, too.
All right.
I was a Bernie fan.
Okay, good. So we have two Bernie fans here, but the Bernie side didn't win. You know, there was some skullduggery going on, and he didn't get the nomination. But the reality is—
I don't think
is,
that the reason why Trump won has anything to do with taxes. I think Trump won— because of dirty politics, and I think people were sick of seeing
the Bernie Sanders supporters were making the point that the wealthy have too much influence in the country.
Agreed.
All right. Hmm. That pitch didn't even make it in the Democratic primary for whatever reason that you want to state, and I may agree with many of those things. There certainly was some skullduggery, mm-hmm. whether it was the release of the emails. There was things going on at the DNC that were going to sink Bernie Sanders. But the point is that position didn't even win in the Democratic primary. And then there was the general election where you had, let's say, you know, Hillary Clinton maybe semi in that camp. And the Republicans won. Donald Trump won. So the class warfare or the rich aren't paying their share, has there been any election where that has won?
I hope not.
I don't think so.
I don't feel like the reason why
Trump won has anything to do with people voting for him because of taxes. I think the reason why Trump won was that people did not want to see a systematic servant serve more. And Hillary Clinton was likely not the best candidate. I happily voted for her once Bernie did not, you know, win. However, for many people, they were uncomfortable voting for someone who has served her entire life and is in their mind a part of the problem. And I too felt like, oh, not Hillary. And I, as a woman, I want to vote for a woman, and that's something that's extremely important to me.
But
it wasn't her, and that's difficult. And at the end of the day, it wasn't anything having to do with her tax. Anything having to do with her ideas on that, it ultimately had to do with the fact she had an overserving.
Surrounded by wealthy people, that was not.
They wanted
the
something
allure.
Different. They wanted change, and that was their idea of change.
Like Hillary Clinton isn't a multimillionaire. Please,
John Kerry,
give me a break.
1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont from Coast to Coast and Border to Border tonight, starting our 38th year on the air. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Mommy, why are we going to the store?
Mom, I want you.
Your child will have different needs at different stages of life, and that includes the car seat. See, car crashes are a leading killer of children ages 1 to 13. Protect your child's future at every stage of life. Go to safercar.gov/the right seat.
A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to Mom. I had no idea how hard it would be and what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and ways for me to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics, but also information about the hurdles I was facing. Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Back in Chicago, and Mike Miller is an economist from DePaul University, and he informed me before the broadcast, this is your 50th appearance on this
50th
program.
I can still remember the very first one, believe it or not.
You remember the very first
one? And
time?
If I had never come back, I would have been pleased. Really? I just thought it was so much fun to be here.
Oh, really?
And when I got that call the second time to come back, I was just tickled. So,
because you were a listener for years,
oh,
right?
For many years. I'm a kind of a political junkie, and okay. I listened to you for the longest time.
Well,
and I got this
call. In the history of this program, we've had many people who were listeners, and then they ultimately became, you know, guests on the show, regular guests on the show.
I don't even know how it worked out, but it did, and it's really cool.
We're delighted to have you. Yeah. And Mara, cool. I think you've been on, I don't know whether you're not counting like the professor is.
I neglected to check that.
You've got to be pretty close, though, because you guys have been on a lot with these.
At least six times, I'm sure.
Well, one of the things we like is to invite bright people here who have differing opinions, and it also gives us an opportunity to sort of float some ideas and things that you get a chance to maybe talk about. You know, in your classes at DePaul University, but you don't really get a chance beyond that. But and you were going to make a point, and actually you made it during the break, and I want you to put it on the record now, is you were making a point on the whole issue of, you know, class warfare and
sure.
Soak the rich and all that. What were your thoughts?
There are actually two of them. One is I understand the idea of a single payer, but, you know, there's only so many doctors, so many nurses, so many beds. They have to be allocated. You will either allocate them by price or you will allocate them by quantity. You will either wait in line or you will pay to get to the front of the line. So by making it single payer, you're not going to automatically make everybody have health care.
That's exactly right.
And in terms of taxes, I know it's this idea that we have to somehow tax the rich because they make more and they don't need that money. And there's something to be said for that. But to a point where it all of a sudden the incentives will lead people to not work as much or to hide the money. Studies have shown no matter how high the top marginal rate is, as high as 92%, which it was in the 50s, or if it's 28% under Ronald Reagan, the government cannot take in more than 21% of GDP. People will simply change their behavior to react to these higher rates of taxes. And I don't know if it's fair. I just don't know if it's fair. So let's say we make the top federal rate 70%, and you live in California, and therefore you have 13.5%. So we're now up to 70%, 83.5%. And then you have the 2% for the Obamacare tax and Medicare tax. You're up to 85%. Would you go to work and work your butt off for 15 cents on every dollar? I don't think you're that good of a citizen. So, I think that's preposterous. I think you're silly.
Amara,
go ahead. So I think that something that's largely missing from these conversations. So I don't believe in taxing the rich because they shouldn't have money, right? It's just not that simplistic. But when there are mechanisms in place that allow people to become extraordinarily wealthy, and some of that is facilitated by the government, where they can take advantage of corporate loopholes, of tax loopholes, because they have access to wealth, they can purchase high-priced lawyers that can allow them to work around tax regulations. That happens. That's the reality.
Oh.
And so it's not necessarily to say we should just tax wealthy people by virtue of the fact that they're wealthy. It's to ask the question about what kind of society do we want to live in where individuals can work 40 hours a week but can barely afford housing or can barely afford any kind of health care.
To eat.
What kind of, right, to eat. What kind of society do we want to live in where we just now pass a paid sick leave ordinance so that people can take time off without having to get fired from their jobs? And we don't ask those kind of public good questions. That's why I'm a supporter of single payer, not necessarily because there's an intrinsic value to people having access to health care, being able to be healthy enough to work, being able to not go bankrupt because they had one illness that bankrupted their entire family.
Larry, what's hard is when you're describing this, it makes...
No, go ahead, Steve. You have to understand, when we're crafting policy or discussing policy, we have to look at recent history and empirical data to decide what's the best choice going forward. The only single-payer system we have in the United States is the Veterans Administration. It is the worst health care program. In fact, the Trump administration is putting together a new panel, new committee, to reform it because veterans are dying waiting to get care. The closest neighbor we have is Canada that had single-payer for years. It was so terrible that a guy named Rick Baker ran a company called Timely Medical on the border, and all he would do is take Canadian citizens with brain tumors who had to wait 9 months for an MRI to get diagnosed over to the Cleveland Clinic. They come here all the time. So it does not work. Single payer works great if you never get sick. Alexandra?
So I was going to be responding to what you were saying earlier. However, you know, ultimately, I don't happen to be a fan of single payer, so I can't really speak to that. And I don't think that single payer is what the United States needs. And so, I think that many Democrats, especially progressive Democrats, do stand with that. That's not where I think our nation needs to go. I think that we need to work with what we have. I think we need to look at what's going on with Obamacare, find the problems that are happening, and fix them. And ultimately, the biggest problem is it's bloody expensive to cover the 10 mandates. And I think that we need to look at these 10 mandates and make appropriate decisions. For me, I'm really sick of the decisions being made on the back of elderly, low-income wage earners, and women. And I'm just sick and tired of watching legislation statistically do that over and over again.
So let me ask you,
challenging for me as a woman, especially a woman who has four children. And in my insurance practice, I work with people of all different wage levels. And I feel very blessed that I've been successful. And trust me, I'm not a fan of writing checks left and right to the Illinois government or the federal government. But at the end of the day, I'm happy to share my earnings to make sure that other people can survive and thrive. And I think that's what it's all about.
Steve, why are you against the states having the option to file a 1332 waiver and develop their own essential health benefits? You just said that you would appreciate that.
Ultimately, I think the issue comes, and we talked about this earlier, that we have states like ours in Illinois where there's a monopoly. Basically, Blue Cross Blue Shield owns our market. And ultimately, it's going to be Blue Cross Blue Shield making these decisions, and it's not going to be what's right for the people and what's needed. Some of the things in those 10 items that, you know, I think could be kind of quickly and easily fixed – Do we really need dental and vision for all children? What's that doing for us other than making dentists not want to be in network anywhere?
Or dentists have to buy it for their kids.
It's like crazy.
They're maddened by it.
And so there's portions of the 10 items that are not working. But at the end of the day, we all know that it's not fair to have pre-existing conditions and waiting periods. You know, for me, things like shortening the enrollment period would really help. I think
Republicans
that's going to be...
Republicans do that in the Senate bill, 45 days.
I agree. That is something in there. That's saying that you asked earlier, what do I like in there? I think we needed to shorten the enrollment period. I think that that's a crucial component to it. You know, selfishly, I don't really want to spend my holidays playing healthcare either.
I think
that, you know, spending all the holidays doing that is difficult. But at the end of the day, you know, we need to work with what we have. We can't just, you know, throw it all out.
Folks, we got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Gary, a lively discussion this evening about health care and the likelihood of the Republican plan moving forward. They're still looking for votes. They're going back to their districts. How are you going to react when your congressman and senator come back home? I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while 1 in 5 children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, 3 more fingers for everyone over 60, 2 over 50, 1 over 40, 1 more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, 2 if you're very overweight, and 3 if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up 5 or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Back on Beyond the Beltway, and boy, during the break, folks, during the break, we did a whole show during the break, and everybody's going to go back to their script, and we're going to see if we can repeat exactly what was said. But we're going to start with Alexandria Eidenberg, who's making her first appearance on our program, as is Steve Tucker, and again, they're doing a great job in carrying the water this evening, along with our other guests. But my question to you is, Alexandria, you were making the point about women. You made a point about, although you are a business owner, and a particular tax might hurt you as a business owner, you are okay with paying the tax or any increased taxes because it's good for women. Did I summarize your point?
We were talking about wages and the increase in minimum wage, and it was a very hard decision for me. As a small business owner, it's difficult for minimum wage to go up. As a woman, women need to get paid more. We deserve more. And when minimum wage goes up, women do better, families thrive, and especially single families. And so ultimately, as a business owner who pays $13 and $15 an hour, I'm aware that if it goes up to $15, that means I have to bump closer to $20, $22 to be competitive, and that's difficult as a business owner. But I choose women, and I choose family, and I know that by raising minimum wage that the people are served, and that's what it's all about.
But that leaves off the table all the women who will be fired because they can't manage the business owners. You just said it yourself. You cannot manage another increase, $15, $17, $19, $20. You're going to fire people.
I will take it on. I'm not personally going to fire people.
But statistics show it happens every time the minimum wage is raised.
Mike, Seattle this week in terms of
exactly
you cannot
right.
pay
in Seattle. Mike.
Seattle, they raised the minimum wage. They're heading it towards 15. I think it's at 13 now. It started from 9 to 11. Right. 9 to 11 had a minimal effect. 11 to 13. Now, one of the reasons maybe is they were slightly underpaid. That's possible. As an economist, the market has to find the right level. But the movement from 11 to 13, the average worker who's kept his job had his income go down an average of $125 a month. The number of jobs has declined. And you're talking about women. You're going to give women more money. You're a woman. You're going to have to give them that money. You
yes.
don't have that money. Mm-hmm. Don't you understand? You can't look at this the winners.
Here's the thing.
You have to
I do. It's less share for losers. Me, and I'm okay with that.
That's good, but don't tell me that I have to do that. Don't tell
right,
me as
exactly,
a business.
Right.
And why should I pay someone based upon what they need, not opposed to what they
but,
produce?
But it
because
hurts.
That's the humane thing
no,
to
it's
do.
Not.
No, it's not.
The
it hurts the people
is not
who are
the
least skilled.
One at a time, one at a time.
Least skilled.
Alexander.
I'm very confused at how we think it hurts people to make more money.
It's
it doesn't deserve just to make a living wage and be able to do good things for themselves.
When you
and
raise
their
the minimum wage,
Steve,
when you
ahead.
Raise the minimum wage, it hurts the people on the lowest end of the income scale. The people on the bottom rung of the ladder who are just starting off. Now there are no jobs for them to have any job experience earned from. So they're never going to get up to 10, 12, 11, 13 and never progress because they have no work history because people like you want to raise the minimum wage and starve them of even having a job.
The principles behind raising the minimum wage is this notion that people should be able to work the standard 40-hour work week and be able to afford to live in their homes, get health care, go to school, and so on and
That's
so forth.
That's what I'm saying.
Now, whether or not that what that magic number is, I think is debatable because it is sort of arbitrary. There's an arbitrary nature to saying, okay, it's $15 an hour. Well, in 2 years, it might be $20 an hour that's necessary to have an affordable, to be able to afford to live. So that's the question, I think. But I think we cannot move away from this notion that there is some value to people being able to work their jobs and be able to afford to live. And until we address all of those other attendant issues that make things unaffordable for people, you're going to see people continue to push for things like having a minimum wage or a prevailing wage or a living wage.
And you're also going to see McDonald's creating kiosks as they are right now all over the country, replacing
all that.
But
the answer to technology is thriving no matter what.
The answer to that is not.
But you're changing.
The answer to that is not to rail against technology. It's to make sure from an education standpoint that we're preparing a labor force for the future that have the skills to operate those kiosks or repair them.
But when you raise the minimum wage, Myra, you rob those people of ever having a job. They get fired in order for the boss to be able to maintain the higher and higher minimum wage for a smaller number of employees. It's just basic economics 101. It's just fact.
And the minimum wage in the city of Chicago just went up yesterday, July 1st.
Just what we need.
$1. It's now $10 an hour. It's now $11 an
hour. Plus the tax increase that we're about
now,
to get hit with.
The other point is that if you're listening around the country, the county of Cook, of which this program originates from, which is the third largest county in the United States, they were going to impose yesterday a major soda tax. Now, a judge has held that at the moment, has that on hold. But the leader of the county and the Democrats that control the county, they were going to put, a pretty onerous tax on soft drinks. And I asked our guests, who's going to suffer more by a soda tax? isn't it the poor?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I want to hear our Democrats respond to that.
So again, my response to it as someone who doesn't drink soda is that we just have to be honest about what this tax is. It's about revenue. Now, my issue with it is in the application of the tax. So you can get a Frappuccino for $5 and maybe that's not taxed. But if you buy the bottle of soda, then that's taxed.
And that frapp's got a lot of sugar.
And it has,
a lot of sugar.
Yeah. So the whole premise of the tax, I think, is a little bit disingenuous when it's really just an opportunity to raise revenue. And this is the easiest thing that they could slap another tax
on. But here's my point. If you are a Democrat living in Chicago, you are living in Cook County. And now you have the Democrat, you have a Democrat mayor. So, the city council, we're going to give you an extra dollar an hour. And by the way, if you like soda pop,
we're going to take more
than that dollar away
because
the Democrats
on
the county are doing it.
Stop drinking
soda if it's not working.
But here's my point.
Jeez.
From a political standpoint, ladies, would you understand that what I've just described is an absurdity if you have, for the good of the city, the city fathers think, okay, we're going to do this, and then you got someone on the county taking probably, it'll take more than that away from them if they drink soda pop. And a lot of people drink soda pop, including me.
I do.
I don't drink soda. Neither of us are soda drinkers.
Okay, so you don't care about you don't care about these.
I think that ultimately it's a high level consumable. It's a consumable that is regularly. The majority at the table is drinking soda. It is a great way for the county to earn money that they need, and we need to tax items that are used regularly. My organization, Mom Plus Baby, fought hard to get taxes removed from tampons because it's a product that only women use. And interestingly.
How did you do?
It happened. There are no tampon taxes. Thank you. I will tell you, though, I did not wholeheartedly support that as much as other board members of my organization because I felt we needed the tax dollar and that taking away the tax dollar was not the appropriate time. However, at the end of the day, it was an unfair tax. So what you're talking about is unfair taxes and who is unfairly getting taxed. The soda drinkers are now going to be unfairly taxed. I think soda is bad for you. And so if you choose to consume it and get taxed, so be it.
It's similar to the plastic bag tax that the city imposed to reduce the consumption or the use of plastic bags for the environment. But really, it was
7 cents. You pay seven cents for a bag.
Let me give you another example, though. The issue always with wages and so forth is something called relative price, the price of one good relative to another. So the county as well put a tax upon ammunition and upon guns. And I happen to live just enough in Cook County when I need both, I can go right across the border into Kane County and buy both of them, which I have done. Cook County was getting a lot of money just through normal taxes from me, and now they're getting nothing.
Same thing with cigarette taxes.
People go right over to Lake County to buy cigarettes all the time.
But you see, that's when you try to manipulate things and you try to create these massive tax bills which try to help this group or that group. You're going to create unintended consequences.
You should be proud when people work the system, though.
A simple tax rule would be so much
superior. I feel like the problem is, let's not be proud when people work the system. I think that it's about participating in it.
But why are we doing it? Because we can't borrow any more money.
1-800-723-8299. I'm Bruce Dumont. More Verbal Donnybrook when we get back.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter, Brooklyn, was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone. I see the future is really bright for me.
No one gets a diploma alone. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Welcome back.
I'm out.
Beyond the Beltway.
That was also your choice.
Welcome Welcome back.
It's totally my choice, but I also choose to work to.
We are having a tremendous discussion this evening, both on and off the air. And Alexandra, you usually during the break you will say something, and everybody will just jump and get all involved. And so we're going to ask you. You were making a very impassioned plea about women and what they're paid, and that they are undervalued and underpaid, mm-hmm. and the other. Guests on this program, our other male guests on this program, they were challenging your point. So make your initial point, and then we're going to hear from the guys.
Ultimately, women are not paid the same for the same role as men are, and it's not fair. Women deserve to get paid the same amount that men do. And earlier what I was saying is women during childbearing years are judged more than anyone else, and even if you don't have children, you never want them. As a woman, you are constantly judged, and I happen to be a woman in childbearing years who has four kids. I want more kids. I work. I love working. I have a successful business. However, it doesn't matter if I had kids or not. I'm judged, and my ability to climb the totem pole is hindered because people do not give me access to jobs or women access to jobs because of the potential for them to have children. And at the end of the day, that's unacceptable. We as a culture need to change that. It is unfair to judge women because of their potential to have children and what that means. And you described it perfectly. In your family, you chose for your wife not to work. And ultimately,
we chose.
Right.
Sorry.
Yeah. Correct. Both of you as a couple made that decision. And some families do make that decision. Others do not. But the concern of employers, women leaving the workplace, that's why they don't allow women to go up the totem pole in the workplace.
There is no economic evidence to support the position.
Zero.
The economists do something. When we do a study, it's called controlling for other factors. You can't say, for example, that I make a certain amount. I make $100,000 and a student makes $20,000. They can't be the same. You have to control for the fact that I'm 63 and they're 20 and they have no education.
And you have a lot of education,
and I have a PhD.
Right.
So we control for it. When you control for all these things between men and women, almost the entire difference in the salaries between men and women disappear. There might be 1-2%, which is unexplained. Now, unexplained means it could be discrimination. It could be something else in the measurement process. But your statement that men and women are paid different amounts for exactly the same jobs is simply incorrect.
Alice.
If it were also true, if the relative price of women was lower than men,
everybody would hire women.
All the men would hire the women because
we're
not stupid.
Of course,
we of course would go to what has the lower relative price, assuming of course that the quality is identical.
Plus, they're much easier on the eyes.
Oh my God! I didn't say that.
Did I just trigger you by saying women?
That is completely
inappropriate
and totally a part of the problem.
Oh, God.
I'm going to let you speak because I think that you had noted that you don't have children.
Let me just close that one more thing.
Say it again for those that didn't hear it. Yes.
Because women are much easier on the eyes than men.
Yeah. All right, Amara.
I don't have children. Over the course of my career and just in looking at this landscape, I have a sister, a twin actually, who does have three children, obviously same age, PhD, whatever, working. But what the evidence has shown, at least from our experience and from research that I've read, is that when you compare women in the same category, that they do get paid less. Now, and that's not even controlling for race. That's not controlling for things like race, gender, all of these kind of characteristics are taken into account when salaries are being determined.
It's hard for me to believe
that a woman of the same educational level, the same experience level, compared to a man is being paid the same. And what you said earlier is that part of that lower wage is because women will take off time for maternity leave. Or they'll take off time. But even that, to me, there's something to be said about believing that women should be paid less because they might take maternity leave.
No one believes that.
But that's the reality.
You're also assuming that they're going to take time off.
There's just no data. And listen, in the last recession, every business owner in this country was looking to cut corners, anything they could during the Great Recession, right? Don't you think one of those brilliant business owners would have thought, hey, if I fire all the men and just hire a bunch of women, I would have saved tons of money.
Sadly, I know men business owners that have done that.
Go
they
ahead.
Actually have several women working for them because it costs them less. And I'm appalled that they've shared this data with me. It happens.
It is illegal to pay women
less
than men.
But it's also completely insane to say that
women are more attractive on the eyes. Let's turn in your friends who fired all the men and hired women.
But
this is hyperbolic nonsense.
I just want to add, Amara, you made excellent points. But you see, what you did is your analysis was very broad in the sense that you talked about classes of workers. you have to, again, you have to control for that. So you almost have to have a PhD who is a woman in sociology at the same kind of college or university. If you say, if you have a man and a woman and they're paid differently, then we have a problem. That's something. But when you even have classes of women with a certain education and so forth, men inherently, just the nature of the labor market, take, for example, the most dangerous jobs. Men, so they might have exactly the same education as a woman, but they're the ones out on the fishing trawlers. They're the farmers. They're the roustabouts pulling the welders, oil out of the ground, and all these people taking very dangerous jobs. If you were to look at just their education and their sex, and then compare it to how much money they're making, oh my gosh, the guy's making more money. It's because you've not narrowed the control group down to far enough
exactly
that
right.
you compare me to you, a woman and a guy. And as long as we have exactly the same job, roughly, even if it's at different universities or something, then we could say there's a problem if we are paid differently. I know that my women colleagues and I are not paid differently. We're paid just about the same, and those of us who paid more it could have something to do with maybe.
And are you a union
more.
Worker? Or
I am not.
You're not. Okay, I know you said you were a professor. Okay.
Yeah, but not union.
There would be a government task force right now out to investigate all of these employers who are firing all the men and hiring women because it is illegal to do so. Illegal in this country to do so, number one. Number two, there is no empirical data anywhere that shows that it's true when you
control
right, control yeah. for those kind of factors.
In the state of Illinois,
Alexandra.
Women.
In the state of Illinois, there was an attempt by the Democrats to create a law and get a bill passed that would allow for corporations to be investigated on what the wages were that they were paying people, male and female, for the same roles. And that bill could not pass because Republicans were so anti. And I thought it was very interesting that Republicans were anti and that they did not want to see if these large corporations were paying fair wages. And I don't want to make it a Republican-Democrat thing, but at the end of the day, the vast majority of the business owners are Republicans and they're trying to protect their own wealth. And I think it's interesting that they don't want us to really see what wages that they're paying to the people and if they want to hide that.
Is that why
and
Hillary
I
couldn't
work with
her,
women every day.
Female staffers less than she paid her male staffers,
but
Hillary Clinton?
But I think this is a legitimate point.
I mean, is that why? Can you explain
well,
that?
Get
why did Hillary Clinton pay her female staffers less than her men?
I'm not aware of that. I've never heard of that.
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry.
I mean, she's the fighter for women's rights, Hillary Clinton.
It's true.
Because it's not true. That's the point. It's not a real situation.
But I think there's a legitimate point to be brought up when it concerns wages. I mean, here in Chicago, we've had a huge issue with corporations not paying wages and wage theft actually taking place. And because there are no regulations or at least some oversight to make sure that they're paying even what the existing minimum wage is, you do have companies that are taking advantage of that and workers who are not getting paid what they should be getting.
Should large companies that leave other cities and come to Chicago and create jobs here, should they get any favoritism at all by the city or the county if they choose to pay their employees a little bit less? Not below the minimum wage, if they choose to pay them a little bit less.
I don't think that that you can say that. I think that part of the attraction to locating in Chicago, if you are a large company and you need a skilled workforce, is your ability to get access to a skilled workforce and to get the kind of workers that can help your business profit. So I don't think if you can find that workforce here, then what's the incentive to pay them less than what they're worth?
Yeah, you're right.
That's true.
That is probably the only advantage of being in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is the workforce. Everything else about the state is a disaster.
And that's our biggest incentive, because if you look at regulations and taxes and things, mm-hmm. that can drive them away. But if we do create or have the kind of workforce that is attractive to them, then they don't really have an incentive to underpay.
It is interesting as well that you mentioned about the government didn't want to look into these data. This study about the Seattle minimum wage, you know who actually is behind that? The government itself of Seattle mm-hmm. said, we want the University of Washington economists to look at this particular. They were convinced that it was going to come out just fine. And unfortunately, of course, it did exactly what demand curves are downward sloping and the number of jobs declined and income per month. Even though the minimum wage was higher, the average person, because they had fewer hours, took home fewer dollars per month.
And a lot of people lost their jobs.
I will say, though, you know, and ultimately, and I go back to healthcare on this, and, you know, one of the – we talked about what can we fix in the healthcare bill. We're watching, and I know, Steve, I'm sure you're in the same boat. I have employers that either are stunting their growth or specifically not letting people be full-time
yep.
in order to
– Thanks, Obamacare. Thank you.
At the end of the day, though, and I don't know if you provide, and I own my business and I provide health care to my staff, and it's something that we do, you know, with a smile on our face, something that we want to do. Ultimately, at the end of the day, we provide it to only full timers, and you can do it for part timers, and we choose to, and that's something that we want to do. And so I think that when we talk about these stunted growths and whatnot, we really have to look at all the factors that are coming into play. And it's my understanding in Seattle that they were looking at some down growth factors in general, and the less hours and whatnot. It's also that they're getting taxed. And it's when you make more, you get taxed more. And so there's a lot of factors that came into play on it.
The only way to tell then would be to look at the counties which surround Seattle and see if it's just a Seattle-related thing.
I don't think they did that in the study, though.
My understanding is that the effects in Seattle, in fact, are specifically Seattle, which makes it clear that it is because of the law, not because it's something going on in the community as a whole.
But it's not even isolated to Seattle. In every circumstance, when you raise the minimum wage, people suffer. People lose their jobs in order for that business owner to be able to maintain the ever higher and higher increasing minimum wage for a smaller and smaller number of employees. It's just the way it works.
And when you look at the employees on the minimum wage, I believe it's something around 85% or 24 or under. And of that, a very large percentage have no high school. They don't have a high school education.
It's the lowest skill, the lowest education.
It's not. Are there? I'm sure there are single mothers who have children, that work the minimum wage. There have got to be some. I'm positive, but that is not the average person there. Somebody from? Did you say you're from Wilmette?
I grew up in Chicago, and I recently moved to Wilmette with my family.
So you've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Bruce Dumont back with calls and more conversation when we roll on from Chicago.
Well, Jason, I've got to tell you, you're pretty much everything this company is looking for in an entry-level candidate.
Great.
Your resume isn't quite what we're used to, but you've got a fantastic work ethic.
Thank you.
And I'm impressed by how you carry yourself.
So, should we talk about the job?
What? The job? Oh, sorry. Yeah, I have no way of recruiting or even meeting you. This interview didn't happen.
It may sound ridiculous, and that's because it kind of is. There's a huge pool of talent your company is missing out on. Meet the grads of life. Who are they? Talent worth knowing about. Young adults of unique determination and experience. An ideal fit for your company in an entry-level position, internship, or even mentorship. They might not have every qualification you typically look for, but they're exactly who your company needs.
Man, we really could have used him.
Don't miss out on a resource many innovative companies have already discovered. Go to gradsoflife.org to learn how to find, cultivate, and train this great pool of untapped talent. Brought to you by the Ad Council and gradsoflife.org.
Back in Chicago, and again, we're talking about the health care debate in the country, and we're having a spirited debate here this evening. And one aspect that I know is of concern to many people, whether you love Obamacare or you're cheering for a Republican plan to replace it. And Steve, I want to get your reaction, and that's the issue of pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
Under the Republican plan that is circulating out there, how do they deal with pre-existing conditions?
Exactly the way it's been handled for about 21 years now. It was first drafted in 1996 HIPAA law, section 2742, among other sections, which state that if you keep consistent health insurance coverage and you move from one policy to the next and you have no lapse more than 63 days between those policies, all your pre-existing conditions will be covered. So they're going to expand that to the individual market. We could have solved the issue with pre-existing condition with affected about 20 million people with adding one sentence to HIPAA law, and we wouldn't have needed a 2,300-page healthcare takeover. But the point is, this is how we're handling it in the Senate. And we're going to penalize people who do not keep consistent coverage by stating that you will not have coverage for pre-existing conditions for 6 months if you do not keep consistent coverage in place. If you do not do that, the entire house of cards falls. You cannot let people wait until they're sick to buy health insurance. People who game the system drive up premiums for everybody else, so we have that penalty there that has to be there.
And here's one other aspect of it. Being one who is watching this, and the people in my family that are in Obamacare both had pre-existing conditions. They tried to get it once they left my coverage, and they couldn't get it because of a pre-existing condition. So they went into something called iChip, Illinois Children and
Illinois
whatever.
Comprehensive
and what
Health
it was
Insurance.
It was a high-risk pool. And when Obamacare came out, one thing I said to myself, why don't we just take the 20 million of us who are in that situation and create the high-risk pool and have the government help them out and give them some subsidy? Just leave the rest alone. Because the question is, if Obamacare goes away, if it just completely goes away, we would, in a sense, go back to where we were before. Why not simply do one thing, create that pool for those high-risk people?
Well, we had them.
Unfortunately,
Alexandra.
So Illinois did. iChip was amazing here in Illinois, yeah. And I totally agree with you. I had a lot of clients that swore by it. Blue Cross Blue Shield backed those policies, which is great.
Yes, ma'am.
We are one of the only states that had something like that.
Well, you would
and
create
so,
it nationwide. The whole point is it works. And I don't know why we had to overturn the entire healthcare system.
You just say we were the
that.
Only state that had something?
We were
like,
one of the only states that had a program
so
like that that was
facts.
Working.
Let's get the facts straight. 35 states had high-risk health insurance pools.
Yeah.
Long before
that were working.
That were working.
Yeah.
10 states had what's called a guaranteed issue individual mandate. And this is one of the exciting things about the waivers that the Senate bill allows states to do. Ohio, for example, did not have a high-risk health insurance pool. They had what's called a guaranteed issue individual mandate. And that required every carrier in Ohio to issue 4% of their block of business to sick people who could not otherwise get health insurance. And once UnitedHealthcare filled their 4% quota, they would refer them to the next biggest carrier in line, Humana, Cigna, Aetna. And they never maxed out 4% for all 20 carriers. And everybody in Ohio had coverage for pre-existing conditions long before anyone ever heard of Barack Obama. Right? And they did it very, very fairly and equitably, and they had an open enrollment period. So you couldn't just jump on and off whenever you get sick. It was once a year, and that's
what
we're
talking
took those
about
ideas.
Hurting, though, the carriers, right? It's the carriers that get hurt when this happens because they're
happens?
The ones paying for the bills, right?
Well, carriers, like in Illinois, it was the carriers that gave a percentage of their profits.
But here's
and,
the thing, though. With
taxes.
The Senate bill,
Alexandra,
if they stab the people on Medicaid, and then those people on Medicaid no longer have benefits, so 84% of that 22 million no longer on Medicaid, we're giving them the opportunity to buy insurance.
Amen. Great.
Yeah.
Great. But
thank
those
God.
Are also the people who are low-income wage earners who can't really even afford the plans.
Yes, they can. Because
and
we're
then
we're continuing
they, if they don't have continuous benefits and they don't keep spending all this money on their health care, and then suddenly they get cancer or they get pregnant or they get heart disease, they're now in a 6-month waiting period, and what happens? They don't get the care that they need.
You understand
and
the
that's
concept
the issue.
Of insurance, right?
State. Of course.
Okay.
I own an insurance
okay.
agency
so
and I'm licensed.
You understand that State Farm would not get into the government car insurance business if you could buy your policy after you wreck your car, correct?
Right. Yes.
All right. So the health
I
insurance
agree with
industry
you, the
must
Affordable Care
work
Act
that way.
Has made it so a carrier that is supposed to be taking on, you know, their people, you know, based on risk. They're taking on more risk than they can afford. What I'm saying is I don't feel bad that conglomerate carriers are bleeding money. That's what I'm saying.
You should feel bad because they're all gone.
They're all gone.
There's three left, okay? The only reason they're
in
coming back
state,
at all is because we're giving them
in
100.
In many states, there's numerous carriers still available.
But we have lost 83 health insurers. There's 50 counties in the state right now that have no carrier at all. There's 1,000 counties in the state that have one carrier. That's it in the entire state in the Obamacare exchanges. This is a disaster. And the reason it is because we let people jump on and off throughout the year claiming a loss of income.
The argument you're making is for single payer in that case.
I know. Single payer is a disaster. You think the government has the money to expand Medicare to everybody? We're looking at a $40 trillion unfunded liability for future generations in Medicare. How in God's name are you going
to
expand that
to everybody?
We seem to
be finding money in the Senate bill to throw billions of dollars at different, you know, representatives in order to make sure that they have what they need for their state.
$130 billion is a lot less money than insuring 330 million Americans.
And that lasts only 10 years. Then what?
So keep
then
in mind as well,
Mike Miller.
That one thing that could be done if we would repeal Obamacare is that you could create an insurance product where somebody it's high deductibility, say $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, but it's catastrophic. So everything above that, the cancer, it's all covered. But you don't make them take maternity and acupuncture and all these other things that are
acupuncture is not covered.
Okay, I was being facetious. But the maternity for somebody my age.
Why? Cancer costs millions of dollars a year. Maternity, $10,000. Why are you trying to get rid of maternity?
Because what if you're a guy? What if you're a
Who
single
cares?
Man?
I can't get pregnant alone. What do you think? I'm like making babies on my
no,
own?
That's
Why
your decision.
Men bear that burden
Don't
too?
Don't you tell me that I have to bear the cost because you
Why
are
Why should
impregnated?
I bear the burden for people that have cancer, heart disease, diabetes, any of these things? The argument goes all ways.
No, that's the idea of having a pool. Having
exactly,
a group
the pool.
Pool
that covers maternity.
But why can't there be a pool that is only of people who want to buy only the basic? And we can't buy that.
Another.
We can't buy
you
that
can.
Product.
And
you
can. And at the end of the day, if you buy it, you have a 2.5% fine for doing so. You have every opportunity to do so.
I mean, for not doing
United
so.
United Healthcare has a fantastic product that you can buy. It's through UH1. It's an amazing product. It is catastrophic coverage. You can make a $20,000, you know, deductible. It has every single amazing hospital and network throughout the nation.
For group, not the individual market.
This is the individual market. United Healthcare One has a product that you can purchase that has catastrophic deductibles. By taking this policy, because it's a non-qualified policy,
you have to pay the fine.
It's not even insurance.
Steve Tucker.
What you're talking about is not even insurance. It's a very dangerous schedule plan. It doesn't give you a lifetime maximum.
It gives a lifetime maximum of $600,000 or a million, depending on what policy you take.
That's awful.
So you're saying that one of the best parts about Obamacare that you love, the unlimited part.
No, that was a very small portion of figuring premiums actuarially and statistically. Most policies covered 6 to 8 million before Obamacare, and very few people
reached
that.
No, they cover closer to 1 million to 2 million.
Nonsense.
Every single policy on group and
nonsense.
Individual market.
I've been in this business for 21 years. I've never sold a policy in 10 states for less than $5 million.
I couldn't have been in business that long.
That is complete nonsense.
Every Blue Cross Blue Shield, United Healthcare, Humana, Aetna, all those policies.
$5 million per person. Blue Cross, long before Obamacare.
Per year, if it was up to the
not
$5 million.
Per year, lifetime.
I want to go back, for those people that may have just tuned in, I want to go back to the question I asked at the beginning of the broadcast. I'm going to start with you, Alexandra. What happens if nothing happens? The Republicans don't get any votes. There's no Republican change. What happens, and how long will Obamacare last?
Right now, with Obamacare, the group market is thriving, and it's thriving in amazing ways. It's creating a relationship for employee and employer to be able to offer those benefits. The individual market, on the other hand, is getting annihilated. It is not working. It is extremely expensive. There's barely anything in network any longer. When does it crash? I think this upcoming enrollment season is going to be our last that functions in Illinois.
Stephen Tucker, same question to you.
I concur.
What happens if Republicans don't get any votes for anything?
I concur. Like I said, I use the analogy of State Farm. They're not going to enter the government car insurance business without a huge check from federal taxpayers. And that's what we need. It's the only way they're coming back. As long as you say they have to cover pre-existing conditions. As long as that happens, they're not going to do it without taxpayer money. Period.
Mike Miller, when these senators and their representatives, primarily the senators, when they go back for the recess, what sort of heat do you think they're going to get? And will they become, when they come back to Washington, will they be stronger, a strong spine, or will they be weaker in the knees?
I think they're going to be probably weaker after talking to people, and they're going to be less likely to negotiate. I think that they've dug in, and I'm not sure anything's going to happen, kind of like what's happening in Illinois right now. Rand Paul was one example. He's not going anywhere, as far as I can tell. You mentioned earlier you think he might come on board.
I do.
I don't read political tea leaves all that well. I'm more of an economist, and I just don't know if he can bite the bullet.
Amara, what do you think? Again, they're going to be up close and personal with their constituents.
I think they'll face a lot of pressure. I think they've actually buckled a little bit just over the last several months with the first attempt, and the Democrats have taken advantage of that. They are getting the pulse of the people and their reaction, and they, I think, won the messaging war. I think the Democrats actually won the messaging war in terms of making people believe that they would lose their health care, and that worked against the Republicans. Again, my issue is they had plenty of time to come up with a plan that they could have implemented that worked,
but that's a misnomer, too.
Don't the Republicans always lose the message war?
Oh, they're horrible at messaging.
They're terrible.
Oh, my God. That's a misnomer.
Yeah.
Tom Price had a very functional health care bill that he wrote called Empowering Patients First Act that was out there ready to go as soon as President Trump won. And in fact, the House bill was drafted from the Empowering Patients First Act. So they were ready to go. The problem is they suck at messaging.
The other thing, I brought this up earlier in the show, and it still bothers me. I'm so pleased to hear that the two of you admit that Obamacare is about to collapse for the individual market, because that's what really matters, especially the people like you. That is what matters.
And the individual market always struggled previously, though.
You said yourself your kids could not
get access to those benefits. Thank you.
We'll be right back. are we going to the store? Mom.
Mom, I want juice.
Mom. Mom.
Your child will have different needs at different stages of life, and that includes the car seat. See, car crashes are a leading killer of children ages 1 to 13. Protect your child's future at every stage of life. Go to safercar.gov/the right seat.
A message from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
I wasn't prepared to be a caregiver to Mom. I had no idea how hard it would be and what I would need to know. Things I never thought of, like how to improve her mood and ways for me to stay positive. Luckily, I found the Caregiving Resource Center from AARP. It had articles about the basics, but also information about the hurdles I was facing. Caregiving Resource Center at aarp.org/caregiving. Articles, tips, and tools to help you both care for your loved one and care for yourself. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
I'm 2 months back in Chicago. My question on a different subject with the one last segment. Mike Miller, when the President of the United States is repeatedly attacked for his positions, his personality, everything, his honesty, integrity, everything is challenged. Does that president have an opportunity and should he use the opportunity to retaliate against the person that's challenging him and questioning him?
Retaliate, that's a strong word.
Yes.
Fight back, yeah, I think he does. And he's not my guy and so forth, but yeah, this is kind of fun to watch.
Amara, let me get your response. We're obviously talking about the tweets by the President of the United States against Mika Brzezinski, primarily, and Morning Joe, but primarily about Mika Brzezinski. He gets beat up by them every single morning. Does he not have a right to fight back?
It's not that he doesn't have a right. It's just that there's a certain level of decorum and demeanor accorded to the office of the president. Mm-hmm. So he's not a coworker or a colleague that you would spar with or go to.
Should a member of the media and someone who has access to a national audience also respect the presidency, even though they may not respect this one, in the way they describe the president? Should they also show a level pulling back a little bit?
I think one thing is tone, right? The overall tone set in this country throughout the campaign season, throughout the last couple of years, it set a tone where almost anything goes. Many things were said from both sides, all around, that I think were outside of the bounds of what should be acceptable in any civil engagement politically, regardless of how you feel about the individual. So I think that tone has degraded the level of discourse. If you are in the media, I do think there's a certain standard. As a media personality, as someone who, if you're hosting a show, there's a certain standard that you should abide by. The same way I believe that if you are president, there are certain standards that you want to abide by, because again, it's not necessarily about the personality that's there, it's the respect that's accorded to that particular office.
Do you think, Alexander, I don't know whether you're a regular viewer of Morning Joe or MSNBC or not, but do you think that in this particular case that maybe the commentators have went too far in blasting the President of the United States day in, day out? And I know that you probably disagree with his tweet referencing her and Joe and the show and the ratings and everything else. But again, what about the level of discourse representing
I disagree with the tweet. Ultimately, when we have a president who's having this kind of behavior, who's outwardly using Twitter as his modality of communication, and often that communication is inappropriate for a president, when we see our media counteracting, we only are as strong as our leadership. And our leadership right now is Trump, and the expectations have changed. As an American who loves being American, I'm pretty embarrassed right now by our president. Not only did he have that tweet about Mika and Joe, he tweeted about him at some wrestling thing, tackling somebody, as though that was presidential.
It was CNN, fake news.
It's embarrassing.
Of course it's embarrassing.
That is not.
Also, if he wants to, that's what surrogates are for. It doesn't have to come from the president. It doesn't have to be him personally tweeting. That's what you have surrogates and even attack.
When Barack Obama said, if they bring a knife, you bring a gun, is that the same thing?
I have no reference.
I'm just wondering.
But I think the principle, I would say the same thing. I think not the president. You use your surrogates, and even if you have your attack dogs, to do that work for you, as opposed to you personally.
It's inappropriate communication.
Inappropriate when Barack Obama said it.
And it may have been if he said that. I wasn't aware of it. But the principle is still the same. You use your surrogates for that. It should not be emanating from the president's personal tweets.
The president has said that it may not be presidential, but it's modern presidential.
Yes, that's what
he said. That tweeting and social media is a modern thing. He fine-tuned it. I mean, he got elected because of it,
yeah.
Just like Barack Obama got elected because he knew what to do, you know, with computer, you know, targeting of voters. I mean, this is a new way of talking. And for Donald Trump to say, hey, listen, I got here by acting this way, and those people who oppose me and hate me, they want me to change my MO.
But we forget why he has to do it. He has to do it because NBC, ABC, CBS, MSNBC, The New York Times, The Washington Post, they trash him 24/7. His only outlet to go around the lying left-wing media is to go directly to the people, just
lying,
like Ronald Wilson Reagan did.
That's the first time the President of the United States has ever been referred to as a schmuck. That's a good program.
But he has to.
And if you're Yiddish, you know what that means. And if you're not, I'm not going to explain.
But if he does that, we have to accept that there are consequences for that, not only within the United States, but there are consequences as to how the United States is perceived around the world by other countries and the leadership of other countries.
Here's a question that I want to ask, because one of the things that he referenced was that, you know, he was talking about how Micah and Joe had gone down to Mar-a-Lago, and then they wanted to hang out with him, and he said no. But he also said that Micah was bleeding because of a facelift. How did you respond to that phrase?
Yes,
when someone refers to a woman who's bleeding from a facelift, should we take that literally, or is he talking about something else? I'm going to just ask our women here how you respond to this.
I was taken aback. I mean, that's not something that you... I could imagine anyone saying just randomly. It reminded me of the comment that he made about the other journalist from Fox News.
Megyn Kelly. But again, in the Megyn Kelly case, he was talking, well, she was bleeding from whatever, mm-hmm. which could have meant that he was referring to a menstrual cycle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm asking our women, as it relates to this thing, when he talks about she was down there, she had a facelift, she was bleeding from a facelift. Did you hear that as a reference to a menstrual cycle?
No,
or do you think that
there
was some
shallow perception of how he perceives or how he views women? So she had it couldn't have been that Megyn Kelly was just doing her job as a reporter.
But in this particular case, if a news person or two news people go down and stay at Mar-a-Lago, it's not firm as to whether or not they asked for a free room down there. We don't know that. But then he did say that they wanted to hang out with the president. Is that appropriate? If indeed
He's
they went down there
often
for that purpose.
Inappropriate in his communication style.
Were they inappropriate? My question.
If they were trying to hang out with him, it was for interviewing purposes, would have been my assumptions. And with the bleeding comment, I think it's hard for our immediate reaction not to be, is he talking about menstruation?
His reaction was to MSNBC host calling him a pig with a small penis and small hands and making fun of him constantly. His whole tweet was reactionary. He didn't start this fight.
We got to pause. Good night, everybody, from Chicago. The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Hey everybody, this is Josh Groban. After so many years on the stage, one of my favorite things about music is its ability to inspire and nourish the soul. That's why I'm proud to work with Feeding America, an organization that inspires hope for families in need and helps nourish the 16 million kids in this country struggling with hunger. Every year, billions of pounds of excess food go to waste, while one in five children may be left not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if it's even coming at all. Thankfully, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks collects surplus food and helps deliver it to kids in need across the country. But they can't do it alone. Join me in supporting Feeding America and your local food bank at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger.
Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
A historic moment from the archives at museum.tv.
There can be no stable and enduring peace without the participation of the People's Republic of China and its 750 million people. That is why I have undertaken initiatives in several areas to open the door for more normal relations between our two countries.
Experience more history at museum.tv.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes, and you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to. Nope. I'm sure you've got a perfectly good excuse. Kids, work. I get it. You're busy. So what better time than now? Let's begin. Raise one finger if you're a man. Ladies, none yet. Oh, count in your head if you're driving. Now, three more fingers for everyone over 60, two over 50, one over 40, one more if you're not physically active, another finger if anyone in your family has type 2 diabetes, another if you've got high blood pressure. If you're overweight, raise another finger, two if you're very overweight, and three if you're really overweight. You've just taken the world's first audio prediabetes test. And if you're holding up five or more fingers, visit doihaveprediabetes.org or talk to your doctor. There's no excuse, because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.